Coming up on the program today, a trillion here, a trillion there. Pretty soon, you're talking real money. Government and business, how they are not the same. And Molly Wood is here with a little surprise from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 24th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The economic news of this Tuesday is brought to you by the phrase, put up or shut up. I speak here not of literal fisticuffs, but the legislative version. President Trump, as candidate Trump, talked a whole lot about a trillion-dollar plan to fix this nation's infrastructure. Details so far have been fleeting, so today congressional Democrats offered a plan of their own. Traditionally budget-conscious Republicans in Congress are skeptical of both approaches, and you throw in a report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office today forecasting steep increases in the federal debt and deficits over the next 10 years, and things get very complicated very quickly. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going from New York.
Pushing forward a big infrastructure bill would mean pushing against bedrock conservative principles of limited spending and smaller government. Greg Mankiw happens to believe in those principles. He chaired President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisers.
Could be a very big fight because Mr. Trump hasn't really come to grips yet with the long-term fiscal challenge facing the United States.
Mankiw's not against upgrading infrastructure. He's just concerned about money spent foolishly.
Most economists agree that infrastructure is a good thing if done well, and it's a bad thing if done poorly.
Getting a deal through a Republican Congress won't be easy.
It really is going to depend on how they design the plan.
Veronique DeRougie is senior fellow at the Mercatus Center.
I can see Republicans going along with it if they're sold with the idea that most of it is going to be through tax credits.
That's facing opposition from Democrats who worry that offering tax incentives to the private sector will lead to projects that won't meet America's needs.
Those are going to skew towards much larger urban areas that are wealthier, that have a large pool of people who have the resources to pay for the tolls.
Kevin DeGood directs infrastructure policy for the Center for American Progress.
Many of the communities that believed in President Trump and thought that he was going to try to deliver for them are going to find themselves left by the side of the road.
Trump hasn't even put out a complete plan yet, but the battle in Washington is already underway. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This fifth day of the Trump administration brought another high-profile breakfast meeting at the White House. The CEOs of Ford, General Motors, Fiat Chrysler, and other carmakers heard the president say that he wants to see new auto plants built in this country. And to that end, he issued an executive action streamlining the permitting process for getting domestic manufacturing projects off the ground, the goal being to reduce what the president called the, quote, incredibly cumbersome, long, horrible process. But as Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains, there are plenty of reasons why auto manufacturers might still hesitate to open new factories here.
Permitting processes can indeed be a big headache for automakers, according to David Cole, chairman emeritus of the Center for Automotive Research. But Cole says that's not really what would keep automakers from building new factories. He says they're probably more likely to add shifts at existing facilities first before breaking ground somewhere new.
You're going to try to look at your global footprint and run those plants at the highest possible utilization rate.
He doubts automakers are likely to add multiple new plants in the U.S. given existing capacity. It takes 2 to 3 years and hundreds of millions of dollars to open a new plant, so says Alan Baum, an automotive industry market researcher. Baum says another reason carmakers probably won't go that route is slackening demand. He says the share of Americans buying new cars and trucks is falling.
In 1960 or 70 or 80, if you were in a middle-class job, every few years you'd buy a new car. That's simply not the case today.
Even if automakers do try to expand production in the U.S., they could run into other issues. Economist Aparna Mater with the American Enterprise Institute says factory owners in general can't even fill the existing job openings very easily.
Even today, there are over 300,000 job openings. The problem is manufacturers say we don't have the people with the right skills to employ in these jobs.
She says older workers who may have gotten laid off from manufacturing jobs in the past now often lack the right skills, and surveys show many younger workers don't want to work in factories. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
One of the things economists like to say when things don't work out the way their policy prescriptions predicted things would work out is, hey, unintended consequences. Not all economists, of course, but some, which gets us to the president's order yesterday instituting a hiring freeze for most of the federal government. No vacant positions can be filled and no federal jobs, new federal jobs that is, can be created. Exceptions being made for the Pentagon and positions necessary for national security or public safety. Sounds pretty straightforward, except, hey, unintended consequences. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
Here's the first twist on the hiring freeze. 85% of civilian federal employees work outside of Washington, D.C.
The hiring freeze will impact communities across the country.
That's Max Steyer. He heads the nonprofit Partnership for Public Service on Government Effectiveness. Steyer has another surprise. He says hiring freezes don't save money because federal agencies can get around them by hiring contractors.
And if you're doing it because it's a workaround, you're not doing it because it's cost-effective or the better way to do it. And that's going to wind up costing more money.
Now, President Trump's executive order does say federal agencies aren't supposed to hire contractors. That could be tough to enforce. But Diana Furchgott-Roth, a former Trump advisor now at the conservative Manhattan Institute, says Trump can limit contractor hires by cutting agency budgets.
So they're going to be limited in what contractors they hire. It's not as though they just have an unlimited wallet.
But ultimately, if President Trump wants to completely restructure the federal workforce, he'll need legislation from Congress. Paul Light teaches public policy at New York University.
Republicans and Democrats alike tend to agree that the federal government has a very large number of highly qualified people, but needs help disciplining the poor performers.
Light expects Congress to work on government reform legislation over the next several years. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, good day for pipeline companies. I'll tell you what, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now that Donald Trump, businessman, is Donald Trump, president of the United States, he is in a position to make things happen. And one of the things he talked about making happen a lot while he was campaigning was making government run like a business, walking away from negotiations, always getting the best deal, driving to the lowest possible costs, all those tenets of business 101 that governments really have never been much good at. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes a look at whether President Trump might be able to change that paradigm.
Running the government like a business is not a new concept.
The idea goes back to the late 19th century when American business corporations were first becoming large and powerful and regarded as very successful.
Lawrence Lynn is at UChicago.
And it comes up pretty much every decade in one form or another.
But what do people mean, ultimately, when they say government should be run like a business?
I suspect they mean with clear objectives in mind, with some sort of customer focus, some sort of economic return, some level of cost efficiency.
Steve Odland, a former CEO, is president of the Committee for Economic Development at the Conference Board.
You know, I think many areas of government spending can be viewed through a private sector lens, like healthcare or procurement of non-essential goods and so forth, where, you know, we're spending billions of dollars and we should do so efficaciously.
It sounds so easy, and who hasn't fantasized about how the DMV might operate if it were a business? But
what often gets lost, however, is that the management environments of the private sector and public sector are different.
David Lewis is professor of political science at Vanderbilt. He says, we ask government to do much more than business and throw a whole bunch of rules at it. You can't buy the cheapest pencils. You got to buy American pencils. You got to fill out these forms to make sure this contractor you're hiring isn't paying you off.
So there are all these rules we put in place because the government has to have social goals that the private sector does not.
And in business, it's easy to measure success. The bottom line, in government, you have social goals that can be measured a million different ways by different people who don't even always agree on what the goals are.
Things like, is the environment clean? Do we have good trade deals?
And government agencies have many bosses, Congress, committees, the president, the people. Lawrence Lynn is at UChicago.
Business people that come into the public sector often say, I'm in a fishbowl. I have to answer to everybody. I have to go up and testify. I have to answer every question. I have to meet reporters. I have to justify everything that I do. I don't want to do that, you know. I want to run my business. Can't do that.
The problem is that government, our government, spreads power out. So it has a little bit of inefficiency baked into it by design. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, now for something completely different. We know Donald Trump wants to run the government like a business, although we are still well short of details about how the president has run his businesses. We're going to be talking about that and a whole lot more on Make Me Smart. It's our new podcast that launches today. Me and Molly Wood talking things over. She is here for a quick preview. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So here we are. It is January 24th, launch day for the new podcast, Make Me Smart.
That's right. It has finally arrived. We're super excited, and we're going to basically bust into your radio programming.
Right,
to,
I'll take a couple of minutes off, you know.
Give you a little preview.
Yeah. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to interview people. Molly and I are. We're going to talk about the news of the week and of the moment. We are also going to take listener questions, because one of the operating theories of this podcast will be that we are all going to make each other smart. You are going to ask questions, we are going to answer them, and then collectively we'll figure out what's going on. And here's one I got on Twitter just the other day. A gentleman wrote and he said, yes, we need to know how deeply our new president is involved in international business, but are we asking too much these days? Did George Washington, back in 1780, whatever, reveal all of his business wealth? So that's, you know, we got 2 minutes, Molly, two and a half. Let's answer that one.
Yeah, I mean, look, I looked up George Washington's wealth and where it came from, and it mostly came from land speculation. So there was a time—
I love that. George Washington was a land speculator, first of all.
He was a land speculator. Right. So you could have argued that George Washington had an inherent conflict of interest as he tried to expand America's territory to get more land he could have speculated on. Right. But it was nowhere near as complicated and potentially impactful as it is now. And I think that's why we keep talking about it. We have some examples of why it's important, one being— the tax returns.
The tax returns. We have never seen them. Kellyanne Conway said this weekend on one of the talk shows, she's obviously his senior advisor, she said he is not going to release them. She tried to walk it back, but the fact is, short of almost anything, Mr. Trump has made it clear he's not going to release those tax returns. So the problem is that we don't know what we don't know about his wealth, his foreign debt, his business entanglements, all of those kinds of things.
And so then we are left to sort of cobble together questions of influence. For example, today the president's expected to and may already have signed an executive order authorizing the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. Mm-hmm. So one thing we do know was that President Trump previously owned stock in the Texas company Energy Transfer Partners that's building the Dakota Access Pipeline, and that he received campaign contributions from the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners. And all the point of asking those questions is the same reason that we ask about campaign finance donations, the same reason we ask about any lever of influence. It's to make sure that you, the person who voted, are being represented as opposed to the business interest. And you could argue that's more relevant now than it probably ever has been.
Exactly. And this even is entirely apart from the lawsuit that was filed yesterday over the Emoluments Clause, any of those suits involving his hotel in Washington, D.C., or Trump Tower, in which a big Chinese bank is a tenant. These are things that we are going to explore on this podcast, me and Molly Wood and experts and all kinds of people, making ourselves collectively smart.
So smart. And you know what? Listen, out there, if you don't have to just ask us questions. If you know the answer, send us that too.
Like if you're an American history professor who actually knows more about the land speculation of the father of our country, please hit us up. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. You can hit us up with an email. Molly and I are on Twitter. Obviously, she's at Molly Wood. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Let's get this thing going because it's time.
It's time. Hey, I'll see you on the podcast, Kai.
Yeah. Yes, you will. Bye.
Bye.
Coming up.
And the way I look at it is that the data is actually the secret ingredient, if you will, to a great guest experience.
Yeah, there's data in everything now, even your food. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 112 points today, about a half percent, finished at 19,912. The NASDAQ up 48 points, about 0.8%, 5,600 on the nose. S&P 500 up 14 points, 0.6%, 22 and 80. News that the president has signed an order to move forward both the Keystone XL and Dakota Access Pipeline's lifted related shares. ETP, which, as Molly said, is building the Dakota Pipeline, bumped up 3.5%. Refining company Tesoro lifted 1.9% today. Navistar up 3.2%. TransCanada, which owns the Keystone Pipeline, spouted 2.7% up in Toronto. Back here, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.46%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There have been so far no executive actions from the White House on immigration. During the campaign, of course, who comes to this country and how was a key part of the president's stump speech. Extreme vetting was the key phrase. Advocates for Syrian refugees in the United States point out properly that they are plenty vetted and that once they get here, they've got, as a group, a strong record of success. Studies show, in fact, that Syrian refugees are far more likely to own businesses than immigrants from other countries and than people born in the United States. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has that story.
13-year-old Obey Saidi is sitting on his living room couch in Brooklyn, taking part in an American pastime, daydreaming about what he's going to be when he grows up. A basketball player? A musician? A superhero? Nope. A dentist with his own practice.
I would want to be able to put my hours, be able to hire people to help me.
It's not the flashiest of career choices, but Obey, who moved from Damascus, Syria to Brooklyn with his family in 2012 because of the war, wants to be his own boss. He says it's a Syrian tradition.
People have in Syria have a certain pride that they don't like working for others.
Obey would be one of many Syrian entrepreneurs in the United States. 11% of Syrian immigrants to the U.S. own businesses, according to the Fiscal Policy Institute analysis. That compares to 4% of immigrants overall and 3% of people born in the United States. Obey's father, Mohammed, now a mechanical engineer in Brooklyn, owned a manufacturing facility back in Syria. He says this entrepreneurial spirit is born of necessity.
In Syria, when you work for somebody, for a company or for the government, the income is not going to be enough to live a good life.
In Michigan, Syrian immigrant Shadi Martini says Syrians also drill it into their children's heads that they have to be self-reliant.
Our parents will tell, don't rely on government. They won't help you. You have to do it by yourself. Government is not there for us. It's there for some people who are in high positions, and that's it.
Martini used to live in Aleppo, where he ran a hospital owned by his family. It was part of a network illegally providing medical care to wounded civilians who opposed the Assad regime. He left Syria in 2012 when that got too dangerous. There's a reason to think the percentage of Syrian immigrant entrepreneurs will drop. The latest numbers are from 2014, but most people who left Syria because of the war, some 16,000 refugees, have come to the United States in the past 2 years. Martini says the two groups are different.
Mostly people who left before was either to get higher education or to open new businesses. People who are leaving now, they had no choice. They had to leave.
Many of them won't have the resources to start a business, at least not right away. But Martini, who leads a group that provides aid to refugees, says they bring the Syrian ethos of self-reliance with them.
Their number one priority, and whenever you meet them and ask them, is how can I work? Because that's the way they knew in Syria.
David Disegard-Kalik from the Fiscal Policy Institute says arriving refugees also have an advantage, an existing network.
Syrian immigrants happen to be a group that have been very successful here, and so they can help in a number of ways to bring along the new refugees.
Even so, starting over isn't easy. In Brooklyn, Zubaida Almajazoub sets down a chocolate cake topped with strawberries on the table in front of her son, Obey, the aspiring dentist. They've lived here for almost 5 years, and Almajazoub says it's still hard.
The weather is different, the language is different, school is different, everything in the life different to my country. But I start again.
Like her son, she dreams of opening a business, maybe an import-export firm, this time in the United States. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
When lay people think about the restaurant business, it's usually stuff like who the chef is, what her specialties are, maybe where said restaurant is, not average check size or how many tables the place can turn every night. And yet a chef's intuition might do well to be partnered with big data. That's the gist of a new book by entrepreneur Damian McGavero. He founded a company called Avera, which sells data software to restaurants. And the book is about the metrics of restauranting in America. It's called The Underground Culinary Tour. Damian, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about first of all, how you came to this. Now, we should say at the start, you founded a company some number of years ago that did big data for restaurants.
Yes, I was a former restaurateur and would ask very simple questions to my chefs and managers, things like, who are your top and bottom servers? Why did your food costs go up? Why your labor costs go up? And they basically gave me blank stares and wrong answers. And I thought to myself, is it just my restaurant group or is it the industry? And so I started the company Avera by bringing together a chef, a restaurant manager, a sommelier, and three techies. Huh. And together we built a team and grew Avera from my studio apartment to now it's 10,000 restaurants in 70 countries.
Like all good startups, you started in your own bedroom. What did you all measure? I mean, is it like, you know, average serving time? Is it what kind of payment form the customer gives you? I mean, what are the metrics?
Yeah, so it's like Moneyball for restaurants. Hmm. The data actually provides a baseball card equivalent. And instead of runs batted in or home runs or on base percentage, it actually will show things like, well, how often are you selling appetizers or how often are you selling desserts or bottles of wine and things like table turn time. And so that really helps restaurateurs better train their staff in the areas they need it.
So I get that restauranting is an extremely low profit margin business and you got to turn the tables and all of that jazz. But if I'm like a restaurant floor manager or a waiter or maybe even down to like a busboy, it's a little bit big brother, man.
Well, data is an important part of so many industries. And the restaurant industry is really catching up to other industries that use data. And the way I look at it is that the data is actually the secret ingredient, if you will, to a great guest experience because you really can't manage what you can't measure.
So if it's all about uniformity, what is – I imagine then that's good for restaurants that – and this is going to sound more boring than I mean it – serve the same thing all the time. But what if you're in a restaurant that changes seasonally or is more artisanal, I guess, would be the phrase?
Yeah. I think that the artisanal part of the business will never go away. In fact, the reason why I wrote this book, it's called The Underground Culinary Tour, based on a real tour. We actually host restaurant CEOs 15 stops in 25 hours. And wow. In there, we want to really help them understand where the future restaurant consumer is going. Because trends that used to take 20 years going from like a New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco, they now, because of social media and technology, they may take 6 to 12 months. And so it's really the backstory of how our dining experience is being transformed by not just the use of data and technology, but the adaptation of trends.
What then do you see as the sort of the food trends, the restaurant trends, not the food trends, but the restaurant business trends in, you know, the next like 18 months?
I believe that food will be a major real estate anchor. What used to be a Macy's or a Bloomingdale's is now being really changed. Now food is the real estate anchor. And for example, this whole notion of food halls.
In Manhattan, there's that thing called Eataly, right?
That's right. Eataly's been on our underground culinary tour as a Avera customer. I mean, you can have so many different experiences with under one roof. But imagine that type of a concept really throughout the country, not just in big cities, but also in secondary cities as well.
It's a book called The Underground Culinary Tour. It's about metrics and restaurants, big data and restaurants, by Damian Mogavro. Damian, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Final note on the way out today with a nod to whoever's running the Twitter feed for Badlands National Park out in South Dakota. This morning at the White House, as Annie Baxter was telling us, President Trump streamlined the permitting process for construction of new factories in this country, saying, quote, environmentalism is out of control. Which gets us to at Badlands NPS. This afternoon, the account has been tweeting out various climate change facts and figures, including, as just one example, this, quote, today the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is higher than at any time in the past 650,000 years, hashtag climate, end of quote. The account deleted those tweets late this afternoon. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 112 points today, about a half percent, 19,912. The NASDAQ jumped 48 points, about 0.8%. S&P 500 up 14.6% there. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Don't forget, Make Me Smart, me and Molly Wood. It's on iTunes. I'm Kai Rizno. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.